content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig deeper into the January issue of Our State Magazine, which is featuring articles all about an old-fashioned winter in North Carolina. And our first up, the article first up is from the Hidden History section of the magazine, and it's entitled Fields of Honor. A historic Rose Bowl pitted Duke University against Oregon State in Durham. Then, in the dark days of World War II, those same football players and a legendary coach joined forces to fight for freedom. Following the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Rose Bowl made an unprecedented move to Durham from Pasadena, California. On January 1, 1942, Duke squared off against Oregon State on its home turf. Lewis Bowling has been a Duke fan for so long, he remembers that when he could walk up to the ticket window at Duke, now Cameron Indoor Stadium, on the day of a basketball game and buy a ticket. Those days are long gone, but that hasn't prevented him from seeing hundreds of Blue Devil basketball and football games over the 50-plus years. Bowling spent his career teaching physical education at North Carolina Central and Duke Universities. Now retired, he writes a history column for the Oxford Public Ledger. He's also penned several history books, including one on the legendary Wallace Wade, Duke's winningest football coach, who led the Blue Devils to 6 Southern Conference championships and the Rose Bowl appearances in 1939 and 1942. The 1942 Rose Bowl game turned out to be the most famous ever played at Duke. Hogwash, you say. Everyone knows the Rose Bowl is always played in Pasadena, California. Make that almost always. The attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, changed everything. Fearing another Japanese attack on the West Coast, military officials canceled the New Year's Day game that was scheduled between the 9-0 Blue Devils and the 7-2 Oregon State Beavers. At the time, Wade was one of the most well-known and well-respected football coaches in America. He'd even appeared on the cover of Time magazine. He'd been the Alabama football coach in the 20s and won 3 national titles there, Bowling said. Then he came to Duke in 1931 and established them as a national power. Wade had high standards for his players. He was definitely a tough taskmaster as a coach, but he also had a heart, Bowling said. Those tough practices led to those players becoming not only better players on the team, but better men after they graduated. Hearing of the cancellation, Wade sprang into action. With approval from the Duke administration, he contacted Oregon State's athletic director. Together, they went to the Rose Bowl committee with an unprecedented offer. Duke would be honored to play host. The game was back on. Wade's reputation and considerable influence had made all the difference. Convincing tournament and university officials to let Duke host the game turned out to be the easy part of Wade's job. Despite his players' devotion to the man nicknamed the Bear, they initially voted down his proposal. Following the attack on Pearl Harbor, many had decided to join the armed forces, and with no fun-filled West Coast trip in the offing, they were relishing a few days at home for the holidays before reporting for duty. Only after Wade agreed to give the team 6 days off for Christmas did they vote in favor. The tickets went on sale December 16th, Bowling says. By December 18th, they stopped because 56,000 tickets were sold. NC State and UNC Chapel Hill pitched in by providing extra bleachers. Although Duke's hospitality was warm, the weather was anything but, with fog, rain, and temperatures in the low 40s. The Blue Devils were heavily favored to win, but the muddy field did not suit their style of play. The game was a back-and-forth affair, with Duke coming back to tie the score at 14-14 in the third quarter. Ultimately, Oregon State prevailed 20-16. Duke played the worst game of the season and still only lost by 4 points, Bowling said. They would have beaten Oregon State by 20 or 30 in the sunshine in California. In addition to Duke's 7 turnovers, 3 fumbles, and 4 interceptions, some credit the outcome to Oregon State's 12th man. NBC announcer Bill Stern asserted that Duke could beat the Beavers by throwing 11 helmets on the field, a comment that some Oregon State players used as motivation. As losses go, it was heartbreaking, but not as heartbreaking as the 1939 Rose Bowl loss to the University of Southern California. Going into that game, Duke was unbeaten and unscored upon, Bowling said. They lost on a last-second touchdown pass. That might have been the most disappointing loss in Duke's history. There was a silver lining, however. Proceeds from that game provided the down payment for what would become one of college basketball's most revered shrines in Cameron Indoor Stadium. In the aftermath of the 1942 New Year's Day loss, all eyes turned on the war. More than 60 Duke and Oregon State players and coaches from that game served. Foremost among them was Coach Wade, who, having been a captain in World War I, re-enlisted at the age of 49. The Army brass made every effort to keep the famed coach out of harm's way, including ordering him to coach an all-Army football team in a series of exhibition games against NFL teams. But in the end, Wade got what he wanted. In April of 1944, he deployed overseas in command of the 272nd Field Artillery Battalion. From August of 1944 to June of 45, his men advanced across France, Belgium, and Germany. They participated in every significant battle during that time, including the desperate last-chance offensive by the Germans known as the Battle of the Bulge. Bowling marvels at Wade's sense of duty. Not many people at the age of 49, as well-paid as he was, as well-known as he was, would have resigned and gone into the military to serve their country, he says. Doesn't that say a lot about who he was? As the German army advanced on Allied positions, Wade's battalion took a position in Rott, Germany, in support of V Corps, where they were subject to shelling as well as strafing and bombing by enemy planes. Having spent 2 days in the brutal cold without food, Wade saw an infantryman brewing coffee and asked for a cup. The soldier, Stan Check, happily obliged. The two men soon realized they had something in common. Check had lined up as the starting right tackle for Oregon State in the 1942 Rose Bowl against Wade's team. Remarkable as this chance encounter was, it can't compare to the events that unfolded in Italy in 1944. Lieutenant Charles Haynes, former backup quarterback for Duke, was heading up a rifle platoon in the 88th Infantry Division. Lieutenant Frank Parker, former Oregon State starting guard, was similarly deployed with Company F in the same division. The two met on a troop ship making its way across the Mediterranean and realized they'd stood on opposite sides of the football field back on New Year's in 1942. While fighting on a ridge near the Arno River in Italy several months later, Haynes was grievously wounded by shrapnel. Clinging to life, he waited 17 hours to be rescued. His savior turned out to be none other than Parker, who'd heard about his friend's predicament and, with another soldier, risked his life to reach the stranded Haynes. Parker hoisted Haynes onto his shoulders and carried him to safety. Haynes recovered, but 4 players from the 42 Rose Bowl paid the ultimate price during World War II. Walter Griffith, Al Hoover, and Bob Nanny from Duke, and Everett Smith from Oregon State. Lewis Bowling talks to ghosts as he looks out over the playing field that hosted the 1942 Rose Bowl game. Bowling makes a confession. Before games, he explains, he stops by the busts of Coach Wade and Coach Cameron, located by the stadiums named in their honor. What a great job you did here, he tells them. I'm just trying to make people more aware of what you did, and I hope you appreciate it. Through Bowling's stories about their exploits, these ghosts talk to us. but it's their resilience and hard work, their honor and sacrifice that speaks volumes. And I'll go through a couple of the pictures and describe a couple of the pictures in here. The first picture is showing the players are just covered in mud on the field at Wallace Wade State, what is now Wallace Wade Stadium. And then we have a picture of Wallace Wade sitting on the field and in a sporty suit and pants and shoes. And years after it hosted the 1942 Rose Bowl, Duke Stadium was named for the man who'd coached the Blue Devils through that game and many others, the legendary Wallace Wade. And that is, of course, the name of the stadium now is Wallace Wade Stadium. Let's move forward. Tickets to the Rose Bowl sold out within 3 days. In order to accommodate all 56,000 fans on that rainy afternoon, the 35,000-seat Duke Stadium borrowed extra bleachers from UNC and NC State. And we show people; it shows people in ponchos and rain gear and umbrellas and such, and it's just packed out. The photo is from the bottom of the horseshoe looking up at the press box, if you know that stadium. Then there's a flyer showing a Duke player and Duke versus Oregon State Rose Bowl. It's like a commemorative card. And then there's a ticket. 2 p.m. Thursday, January 1, 1942, Durham, North Carolina. Enter the West Gate. And it says on here, transferred for this year to Durham, North Carolina from the Pasadena Rose Bowl in California. The price was $3.89. Federal tax was 39 cents. State tax, 12 cents, for a grand total of $4.40 to get a ticket to the Rose Bowl. Okay, moving on to our next article. It's entitled Pearls of Wisdom, and Pearls is spelled P-U-R-L-S, which, of course, those of you who may know, that's a stitch in knitting. For a group of like-minded crafters in Wilmington, knitting is a lot like life. When the going gets tough, when the going gets tangled, they know they can always count on their friends. A gathering of the Cape Fear Knitters has high spirits of a family reunion. In their monthly meeting spot, the third-floor conference room at Navant Health New Hanover Orthopedic Hospital, members soon find their seats and take up current projects. Some comprise just a few rows of stitches. Others spill luxuriously across knitters' laps. Appreciative murmurs overtake the gentle click-clack of knitting needles as a show-and-tell reveals elegant garments made from glistening artisan yarns. Many knitters stand for a better look at the bed-size coverlet with central floral motif and gradient color bands that was as much a mathematical achievement as an artistic one. It's rare to see members pause their rhythmic knit and purl stitching for anything but helpful instruction or a shared laugh. For them, knitting is more than a mere pastime. The craft empowers creativity, cultivates mindfulness, and provides a tight-knit foundation for friendship. And for some members, like Kathy Coons, knitting stirs fond family memories. Coons has a passion for completing pieces left on needles by others. Today, she's working on a blanket that her mother left unfinished when she died in 2017. I figure you'd be able to tell where I took over, Coon says, but she taught me to knit, and our stitches match. This treasure will be kept in the family to be given to an eagerly anticipated grandnephew. The Cape Fear Knitters first came together in June of 2005. Barbara Rowe, a former curator at the Cape Fear Museum, and Judy Chelminski, a museum volunteer, envisioned a group that would be both educational and charitable. The club quickly attracted knowledgeable knitters, many of them transplants to Wilmington who were seeking friends with shared interests. Shelby Brock, the youngest active member at 32, initially felt overwhelmed at the presence of such skilled craftswomen. They embraced her quickly, however, and 2 months after joining last year, she taught a class on using knitting machines. For these ladies, it's not just about making a sweater, it's about the process, which what it takes to make something that's really special, Brock says. If I have a question, they'll know the answer. There are so many you can rely upon. At 90, Noreen Wayland is the eldest member. A few years after I moved here 21 years ago, I met three gals who saw me knitting and asked for instruction, she said, leaning on the arm of her walker. We're still best friends. For me, the greatest joy is connecting with other knitters, people who really get it and appreciate the craft. The members are bonded not just by their extraordinary skills, but also by their good humor. Nancy Carnegie playfully encourages applause as she fluffs the graceful drape of a long lace shawl. It took 2 years to knit the intricate pattern on tiny needles with cobweb weight wool yarn, a task that requires her to gaze through a magnifying glass. Are you donating this to one of us? A member jokes. I'll leave it to someone in my will, Carnegie replies. She enjoys the complexity of such knits, but their delicacy requires some caution when wearing them. A friend's charm bracelet became so ensnared in one during a hug that it had to be cut loose. She was mortified, but I just tied it off and fixed it at home, Carnegie says. You'd never know to look at it now. For her part, Brock brings a youthful vigor to the table. An obsessive crocheter, she discovered Cape Fear Knitters through a chance encounter with a lively cluster of members that meets weekly at a restaurant. I learned to knit at church when I was 7, and I really appreciate the social aspect of it. It always starts a conversation. It also invites requests from strangers at a bar where she often goes to crochet and meet a friend. In fact, she and the bartender have a running joke about her passion. It's like bingo, Brock explains. When someone comes up and asks me to make them a hat, I get a free drink. No kidding. I haven't paid for a drink there in 3 years. Click-clack, click-clack, the needles keep moving, rows of stitches adding up. In addition to the knitter's personal triumphs, there's also a mountain of hats, socks, mittens, and baby blankets, each made with love for neighbors, served by local charities. Just as Rowe and Szymanski hoped, the spirit of service remains a big draw for Cape Fear knitters. More than 200 items will be made during 2024 will be distributed among several area nonprofits. Simpler projects for the charity program are ideal for older members whose hands can no longer manage fine artisan yarn or demanding patterns. Still, each piece is a testament to a lifelong love of knitting and stubborn insistence on beauty in all things. I met someone who said you can knit a stitch and say a prayer for the person who will receive it, Carnegie says. It's lovely and peaceful. Together, the members find joy in knitting hats, baby items, and prayer shawls for others. And to know that someone will receive one of these items and take comfort in its handmade warmth is in itself a gift. And I'll go over a couple of these photos that are accompanying this. The Cape Fear Knitters creations include a pink blanket by Tina Louise Mason, lace shawls by Nancy Carnegie, and handmade hats, socks, and more for neighbors in need. And this lace shawl is just a very intricate pattern using very, very tiny gauge of wool yarn. And then we have a picture of a pink, looks like perhaps a throw for a bed, but it's variegated shades of pink, mauve, and like pale pink. The close bond among members helps them navigate life changes as well as craft projects. And it shows a picture of Kathy Coons, who completed that blanket that was begun by her late mother, who died in 2017. Another photo shows just table upon table upon table of round tables with probably 8 to 10 knitters per table in the hospital setting. in the break room, I guess at the hospital, the cafeteria. And, then it shows that Nancy Cardigan, who used the magnifying glass to knit her delicate lace shawls, and it shows her using that magnifying glass. Fellow member Shelby Brock celebrated her birthday by making herself a white knitted crown. The Cape Fear knitters make cozy items for friends as well as for those in need. And Cast On. Cape Fear Knitters, a chapter of the International Knitting Guild Association, meets from 10 a.m. to noon on the third Saturday of each month, except for July and August, in the third floor conference room at Novant Health Center, New Hanover Orthopedic Hospital in Wilmington. Knitters and crocheters are welcome to attend and consider membership. For more information, contact Jill Corwin at jcorwin320@gmail.com. And Corwin is spelled Corwin, jcorwin320@gmail.com. Our next article is in the section, North Carolina Noted, listening to music that's shaped our state's history, culture, and people. The article is out of Greenville and is entitled Sacred Soul. The poignant voices of gospel music seem to rise from the soil of eastern North Carolina. The genre's lineage is as rooted to the land as the crops growing in its fields. One by one, the five young women of faith and harmony file to the front of the room, all sweetness and light. In matching hot pink dresses, their hair done up in braids or bleached white as fleece. With minutes, they're calling out to God. Praise him, singer Christy Moody shouts, and four others respond in kind. Drums clatter, a bass line bounces, and a pianist pounds away on his keyboard. Moody ratchets up the intensity. She is jumping now, the others following her moves in a sort of choreographed chaos. Praise the Lord, Moody calls out, and again the others respond, praise him. Toward the end of the song, the fluorescent space inside American Legion Post 39 on the southern edge of Greenville is like an ocean of outstretched arms roiling like waves on a turbulent storm. Handheld fans and elaborate Sunday hats flutter like gulls following a trawler. Tears smear mascara on faces lined by age and hardship. Faith and Harmony is here today to celebrate the 56th anniversary of the Spiritual Layers, a legendary Pitt County gospel group. One of its founding members, the late Johnny Ray Daniels, was married to Dorothy Vines of neighboring Greene County. She led another acclaimed group, the Glorifying Vines Sisters, who came out of the Union Grove Free Will Baptist Church of Farmville in the late 50s. In eastern North Carolina, the Daniels and Vines families are gospel royalty. Among the 10 ensembles performing today, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who's not related to a fellow musician. Faith and Harmony, granddaughters of Dorothy and Johnny Ray, are just the latest in a rich bloodline of vocal groups whose mix of country, soul, and rhythm and blues taps into a spiritual tradition stretching back to the field hollers that their enslaved ancestors brought over from Africa. Plopped in a folding chair, watching singer after singer pour their hearts and souls into music that's inextricably connected to eastern North Carolina soil, my mind drifts back 45 years. I'm in my freshman year at East Carolina University, driving out of Greenville on NC Highway 903 in Pitt County and headed into the agricultural sprawl of Greene County. By my side is my college sweetheart, Sharon, who was raised amid this expansive farmland, spent summers pulling tobacco for extra cash. She rolls down the window. See that little church, she says, pointing to a tiny white clapboard building way out in the middle of a field. Faint shouts of sacred soul music drift into the car. They'll still be singing when we come back later this evening. It's my first time hearing African-American gospel music in its element. Oh, I'd seen black and white TV footage of Mahalia Jackson belting out How I Got Over at 60s civil rights events. But hearing this music amid fields of tobacco leaves swaying in the wind, I feel it. The scratchy guitars and pounding drums. the deeply moving organ swells, the heavenly harmonies. These are ancient, primal sounds, the bedrock of every other music, every other kind of music that I've ever loved. Back inside the American Legion building, scents of fried chicken waft from a kitchen area, pulling me into the present again. Next to a brick fireplace displaying photos of local military heroes, women dish out Sunday dinner in between performances by other groups, including Dedicated Men of Zion, fronted by Johnny Ray Daniels' son, Anthony, father and uncle to the members of Faith and Harmony. And when I step out into the darkness, 5 hours later, the extended Daniels and Vines families are still singing. And to finish this out, I will read a portion of an article entitled Digging Deep. Taters. My grandparents raised some sort of russet or kennebec, I suppose, but they referred to all varieties other than sweet potatoes as arsh taters, their Appalachian vernacular for Irish potatoes in the lyrical accent that graces my family's mother tongue. I've read that the Andeans, the first people to cultivate potatoes, have more than 1,000 words for their crop. Potatoes were one of the first foods grown in outer space, and this thought delights me. Decades have passed since my days spent digging spuds, yet a single whiff of wood smoke or roasting potatoes rouses those memories. Our food memories, even the wordless ones that are nothing more or less than an aroma wafting across a thought, feed the stories we tell ourselves in the world about who we were, who we came to be, and who we might yet be. Other than notes from long-ago song, I can think of nothing more evocative than the peerless aroma of something familiar, reassuring, and delicious. It's instant time travel along the crooked paths back to our personal history. I have no doubt about details wrong. I no doubt have details wrong about those garden fires, a few images whittled down by time and others sharpened by my need to hang on to them, but lack of precision doesn't diminish the power of my recollections of those phoenix potatoes, the persuasion of food memories rooted deep within us, both good and bad, for better or for worse. Isn't accuracy, it's association. Proust has his mandolines, this little mountain child inside me has her taters. This issue, the January issue, was a rather short issue, so I was able to read most of the articles in this issue. If you want to hear more from the Storytellers podcast, you can hear each author read this month's story on each topic by going to ourstate.com/storytellers. Well, that does indeed say we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. And so long until next time.